Live from Chicago, this is Dan Proft in for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Pat Hughes, former Republican primary candidate for U.S. Senate, Democrat Salim Muakil, senior editor of In These Times magazine and host of the Salim Muakil Show on WVN Radio in Chicago, and Khalid Marar, assistant professor of political science at DePaul University in Chicago, and author of The Arab Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Our program tonight comes to you from our home base at the offices of the New Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street in beautiful downtown Chicago. Our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Our email address is btb@museum.tv, and the website is beyondthebeltway.com. I'm Dan Proft, as I said, sitting in for Bruce Dumont, who is traveling a well-earned vacation after opening the Museum of Broadcast Communications and getting this off the ground, this beautiful new facility. I want to start our conversation tonight by talking presidential politics. Before we get into the ongoing debate between Republicans and Democrats about the debt ceiling, which we're now 30 days away from that deadline, if you will, big news at the end of June is the reporting of money on hand by all the presidential candidates, with a particular focus on Republicans, of course. Barack Obama had targeted $60 million raised for the second quarter. All of the Republican candidates are significantly less than that, but Mitt Romney, as expected, seems to be lapping the field. He reported about $20 million raised, and most of the rest of his competitors are at about $4 million raised this past quarter and less. Salim Muakil, what is your sense of where the Republican field stands currently, and is President Obama looking at these numbers and the Republican field and smiling?
He may be smiling. I don't think that he should be smiling. Romney is doing what is expected. I think the big surprise, of course, is Michelle Brockman. She seems to be surging in a way that a lot of people didn't expect, and it indicates really the vitality and the energy that is being injected by the Tea Party forces. And I think that has, because there has been so little public demonstration of their power of late, I think people have forgotten about the passion that they injected during the midterms. And I think that passion is still there, and it needs to be closely monitored by Democratic forces.
And Bachman has yet to report her numbers as of this show, as far as I've seen, her fundraising numbers, but according to some recent polling, she's right there in terms of Iowa, the Iowa caucus.
Yes.
Our Republican tonight is Pat Hughes. Pat, is this Romney's race to lose? Is there anybody else? Is there anybody in the field now, or maybe with the entrance of Rick Perry, that you see with the potential to derail a Romney nomination?
I think it's fair to say, Dan, that Romney is the front runner and by a decent margin. I was recently at an event with Governor Tim Pawlenty from Minnesota, and I think he makes a very good candidate. He's very good speaking with us, but I'm a little disappointed that he hasn't broken out of the pack. I think part of the reason for that is that Bachman is holding his numbers down, and she's sort of emerging as the darling of the conservative right, just like Salim said. So I do think that Romney's a front runner. I think that Perry could potentially be a game changer, although he's got some baggage related to some of the things he said and the fact that he's a governor of Texas, which I think a lot of people are going to attribute to their feelings about George W. Bush. But sitting here right now today, I'd be very surprised if it wasn't Romney.
And Professor Marar, Khalil Marar, what's your take on both sides? And frankly, coming from a professorial background, the quality of the debate in terms of the substance of the issues being discussed, both the domestic and foreign, to this point, particularly among the Republican field, since they're trying to flesh out who their nominee is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have an interesting pack on the Republican side. What I worry about is the fact that you basically will have the least worst candidate coming to the fore. And I think that the Democrats would do themselves a disservice to just kind of back off and think that the Republicans are going to implode. They're not going to implode. I mean, the truth is we have a high unemployment rate. We have an economy that really is just in shambles, one of the worst since the Great Depression. And we basically have a situation where the President of the United States will really not be able to tout his economic achievements in any way, shape, or form. Now, as to the debate, it's too early to tell right now where the debate is going, but I do know that it's bereft of any original ideas. I mean, you basically have the Democrats who are trying to trumpet war-making much more than the Republicans, and then you have the Republicans on the flip side saying that we're not doing enough in terms of our war-making abilities. And I fear that we basically have really one side of the debate with both the Republicans and the Democrats competing for who can one-up the other.
Who could be the most bellicose.
Well, yeah. but have you been surprised? Because in the debate in New Hampshire, it seemed to me that there was an unusual amount of restraint among Republican candidates with respect to U.S. intervention. There's going to be a use of force vote regarding Libya in Congress this week. And it seems to me that Republicans were not too quick to criticize Obama with respect to his speech and the drawdown in Afghanistan. Some Republicans, Lindsey Graham and others, have been. But generally speaking, they're not beating the president up too much about that. They're certainly reticent for more commitment in Libya, much less desiring more definition from the president on what we're doing in Libya and what success is going to look like. So it seems to me Republicans could almost there's concern about Republicans almost withdrawing and being kind of a Fortress America party.
There's definitely that danger, but we have to remember that the freedom agenda was started by George W. Bush, the former president, President Bush, and I think that Obama's a wild card because he really took their agenda and pushed it even further to the right. Obama's talking about not necessarily regime change, but he's definitely talking about this new Middle East that really was commenced by George W. Bush. And the Republicans cannot, you know, with the exception of like somebody like a Paul, you know, that
Ron
libertarian.
Paul. Right.
Yeah. You basically have a situation where the Republicans are being beat at their own game. And, you know, we have to remember that Obama was the one who killed bin Laden. It was not George Bush. After years of trying, Bush failed. Obama succeeded.
But, Salim, does Obama risk a enthusiasm deficit among his base with
Absolutely.
His actions in Libya and elsewhere?
Absolutely. An enormous enthusiasm deficit. And the opposition is growing in the African-American community about these kind of warmongering policies that seem to echo what George Bush, as Khalil was talking about, basically echo his particular policies. And the opposition to Obama's actions in Libya are kind of a mixture of just blind opposition to whatever the president proposes. A lot of Republicans oppose. And then, of course, the Ron Paul libertarian vote, which is, I must say, admirably consistent. He has been anti-war with when the Bush administration was there, and he's maintained that particular position. So, it's a really ironic kind of arrangement to have the Republicans urging restraint in a military campaign, and the Democrats urging more aggressive policies.
Pat Hughes will be back with your reaction to that and your calls on Beyond the Beltway. Dan Proft back with you, sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway. We're talking presidential politics. And before the break, we were talking about this kind of unusual development of Republicans seeming to take issue with President Obama for maybe being too bellicose and too interventionist, even despite the George Bush kind of war on terror policies of extending freedom to the Middle East where we can. Pat Hughes, a Republican tonight, wondering what your reaction was to President Obama's position on the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan, particularly despite the fact, as Lindsey Graham, that exchange Lindsey Graham had with generals, where he basically got the generals to concede that the Obama drawdown was more aggressive than any option that we put on the table in terms of removal of troops. And then also with the forthcoming vote this week on the authorization of use of force in Libya.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, you know, just going back to what we were talking about before the break, you know, there's a reason why President Obama has acted on these issues and other foreign policy issues like Guantanamo, where he's kept it open and renewing provisions of the Patriot Act, things that he campaigned against. It's because, you know, when you're campaigning to be president of the United States, it's very different than actually being the president of the United States. And what happens to this president, as it had to many, is they get in office and they realize what's actually going on in the places where we've taken a position of somewhat intervention. And so from that perspective, I think that what President Obama has done, at least in those instances, has been responsible. And I'm not one to compliment the president very often, but in following some of the Bush policies, recognizing the threat that we have. I think that's the second point I'd like to make as it relates to Afghanistan. You know, the threat that we face as a nation is that a loose nuclear weapon will make its way from the Middle East to our shores. And then what happened on 9/11, instead of the tragedy of the buildings coming down, you'd lose entire cities, New York City, Washington, D.C. And, you know, as everyone knows, Afghanistan is a neighboring nation to Pakistan. Pakistan's a nuclear power. And the thought of a loose nuke getting out of there is extraordinary in terms of its consequence. And so I think that it's important that we recognize, first and foremost, why we went to Afghanistan and why we did the surge. I don't think Obama did enough of a surge at the time. I think the drawdown's a mistake at this point. I think it's too aggressive. And it shows sort of how he vacillates. You know, he's trying to have both sides of a very difficult political issue. He wants to appeal to his base in some respect and draw down troops, but at the same time, he fundamentally recognizes the threats that are in place. And it's the same thing with Libya. So I think he's taken some steps that are responsible, but he has this tendency as campaigner in chief to try to draw back to his political base in order to get reelected. And I think that's a real question mark and something that I'm concerned about as we head towards the presidential election.
But is there a coherent Republican position in with respect to Afghanistan, with respect to Libya, with respect to our overarching approach to our interest in the Middle East?
There isn't a coherent position, Dan, because our party, both at the state level and the national level, isn't coherent as a party. Oftentimes on both sides, including the Republicans now, they want to take shots at President Obama because it's the political season or becoming the political season. And so there are some folks who will stick to what they think is, you know, what needs to be done for the benefit of the country. And then there are others that want to try to take the president down politically. And as a consequence, you get some lack of coherency, even in our own party. And it's something that they need to take better responsibility of going forward.
Our phone lines are open, 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. And on those phone lines, we have Joe from Schaumburg.
Yeah, how you doing, panel? I want to talk about 2012 presidential politics, if I may. As an Obama supporter, I welcome a Mitt Romney candidacy because you guys got to admit, this guy's got a lot of flip-flops. First of all, he has the gall to talk about President Obama's economic record when his economic record in Massachusetts was absolutely dismal. Wasn't it rated 47th in job creation?
And
I mean, I know you're not a big fan, Mr. Proft, of Mitt Romney.
That is
true. But the thing is, I think for him to win the South, he's going to have to choose somebody like Michelle Bachmann because, say, you know, people could say it all they want, but a Mormon, I don't think, could win the South.
Well, Joe, just before I turn this over to the panel, are you an Obama supporter categorically, or are you an Obama supporter just as in terms of a potential matchup with Romney?
No, I've always been an Obama supporter. I think right now, to be honest with you, Mr. Prof, the people in the field, I think he can beat anybody right now there. The one that does worry me, and I'll be honest with you, as an Obama supporter, is Rick Perry. The only one that worries me. But Mitt Romney doesn't worry me because, again, this guy's got a lot of flip-flops. Tim Pawlenty might have chickened out as far as Romney care goes that night at the debate. But believe me, President Obama won't.
And Rick Perry worries you because?
Well, because, I mean, he could point to his economic record in Texas, even though Texas is one of the low-paying states around. I mean, but still, his economic record in Texas, he's the only one that worries me. But as far as Romney, I mean, come on. Look at his record in Massachusetts. Absolutely dismal as far as job creation.
This guy had
the gall to talk about the president's economic record.
Thanks for the call, Joe. I appreciate it. Khalil, what's your assessment of Joe's assessment?
Well, I think he's right on. I mean, I think that is not to say that President Obama has, you know, it's not going to be a sham election. I mean, he's going to have a real challenge with the economic condition the way it is. But at the same time, I don't think that the Republicans not only have an incoherent message, there's really an absence of a message. There's an absence of an alternative because Obama has beat them on the foreign policy end. On the domestic end, the Democrats went hands down. Maybe not the Democrats as a party, but definitely the Democrats as embodied by President Obama. I think that the devil we know, even if you dislike Obama, and there's really very few Americans that truly just hate the guy, you know, there's a lot of hatred from the fringe, but the ordinary mainstream American public really doesn't dislike the guy, right?
But do they dislike where the country is right now, and does he ultimately pay the price for that distaste of where we are as a country?
Yeah, the majority of Americans think that we're headed in the wrong directions, but an equally compelling majority thinks that that's the President Bush has committed the country to that course, and Obama's just simply trying to clean up. And that's the message. That's the way it's been.
Pat Hughes.
Yeah, Dan, thank you. I disagree. I think that the Republicans are in a very good position. A lot depends on who comes out of the primary process. But the reality of it is President Obama is one of the worst presidents we've had in modern history. The economy is in shambles. He is a poor leader. His opinion polls have dropped consistently over the past many months, including even after he captured and killed Osama bin Laden. And the reason is I think that Americans see him as a weak leader. We saw this at the midterm elections when the Republicans overwhelmingly took over the House. I think that if things continue along this course and there's no indication to think currently that it'll change economically, that he's going to have a very, very difficult time getting reelected.
He's going to have a difficult time if the economy doesn't improve considerably. And if it doesn't improve, I think that improves Romney's chances, although as the caller pointed out, he has many, many flaws, and he is very vulnerable to a challenge from the right in the Republican Party. I think that President Obama's the way he's alienating much of his base is in fact part of his political maneuvering. As Khalil pointed out, he's kept the Republicans off balance. They really can't get a bead on him, and so consequently, their opposition is incoherent. And the foreign policy realm is a very good example of this. He's shifted the ground so effectively that they really don't know where to attack him, and that may serve him in very good stead as we go further into the campaign season.
I want to talk about the debt ceiling and some of the other domestic issues under this umbrella of the economy. The election's about the economy. Yeah. But this week, yet another federal appeals court weighed in on Obamacare and ruled Obamacare constitutional, including the controversial individual mandate. I think, you know, if you're keeping score at home, I think that's four federal appeals courts that have ruled it constitutional in whole or in part, and two that have ruled it unconstitutional in whole or in part. Obviously, an issue the Supreme Court is ultimately going to have to take up. They ducked it, or they passed on it this year. They're probably going to take it up, one would think, next term. If the Supreme Court takes it up and makes a decision about this time next year, or releases their decision, you know, 5 months before a presidential election on probably the defining issue of his first term, does that have the potential to, especially if Romney's the nominee, let's just play out that hypothetical, does that have the potential to galvanize Obama supporters if Obamacare were struck down by the high court, or galvanize Republicans if it were upheld? And how would that play, particularly with Romney and his Romney care problem in Massachusetts? Pat Hughes.
Well, I'm going to have to get out my crystal ball for this one, Dan. It's a very good question. First of all, I think that the individual mandate is unconstitutional. I think that five members of the Supreme Court, as currently constructed, are going to determine that. I think the problem with Obamacare, though, isn't its unconstitutionality, although that's a huge problem. It's the fact that it's not very popular. It's not a popular law. People don't want it. It's lost momentum ever since it's been passed, and it's a giant anchor. And so earlier when we were talking about how are the Republicans going to attack Obama as we go forward, I can tell you exactly how. You have 9.1% unemployment nationally. You've got his single largest piece of legislation that he passed, a giant lurch left, an incredible governance of the federal government over people's lives, which is extraordinarily unpopular. He's still embroiled in wars that he promised his supporters that he'd get them out of, and now he realizes that it doesn't make sense from a national security perspective to do that. That's the narrative. It's three main points, and it's going to take President Obama down as president if, in fact, we have a good candidate who can deliver that message.
Well, we have to consider why what's been termed Obamacare is so unpopular, it's because it satisfies nobody and tries to placate everybody. I mean, the truth is there was a lot of support in this country for a single-payer system. And since we didn't get that, the left doesn't like it. The right doesn't like it because it's exactly what you said, too much government intrusion over people's lives, right? But we need to have something. I mean, the healthcare system in this country is broken. I mean, it works for some, it's broken for most. The question should be, what is government's role in that? And I don't think that the Republicans have an answer for that, nor do the Democrats. The Democrats' answer is as unpopular as the Republicans' answer. But this notion that government should play an active role is something that's very popular with just the folks, the ordinary folks, ordinary Americans who are denied healthcare on a daily basis.
We're going to pick up the discussion there, and we're also going to talk about this looming debt ceiling vote and the controversy associated with cutting spending in Washington, D.C. when we come back on Beyond the Beltway. Dan Prof, back with you on Beyond the Beltway, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. I am a talk show host on WLS here in Chicago, and Bruce is enjoying a well-earned vacation over the Independence Day weekend after opening this beautiful new Museum of Broadcast Communications from which we are broadcasting. I am joined tonight by Pat Hughes, who's a former Republican candidate for U.S. Senate here in Illinois. He's also a real estate developer and an attorney. So politician, developer, attorney could not be a more lethal combination. Our Democrat tonight is Salim Muakil. He's a senior editor of In These Times magazine and a host of the Salim Muakil Show on WVON Radio in Chicago, a very popular radio station that's geared toward the African-American community in Chicago. You can hear his show 6 to 10 p.m. on Saturdays and 7 to 10 p.m. Wednesdays and Thursdays, right? All right. And Khalid Marar is an assistant professor of political science at DePaul University here in Chicago. He is also the author of a book, The Arab Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which you can pick up on Amazon.com. And we'll be talking more about the Arab Spring with Khalil a little bit later in the show.
I'd like to ask about the Arab Lobby as well.
And the Arab Lobby. We'll be talking about that too. But now let's get back to the phones. We're talking presidential politics. And we've got David from San Francisco, California with us.
Hello?
Hey, David. Go ahead.
Actually, this is JP.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have JP from Waukegan, Illinois with us. We'll get to David. Hold on, David. JP from Waukegan. Hey, JP, go ahead.
Yeah, what I want to point out is that of all the predictions that candidate Obama and President Obama have made, the only ones that seem to have come true is that his policies would make the cost of energy skyrocket. I mean, look at what happened. Follow the trail. In July of 2008, oil hit $144 a barrel. Mm-hmm. President Bush lifted the executive ban on oil drilling, and the speculators fled. The price plummeted to $34 a barrel when President Obama took office. President Obama immediately reinstated that ban, and the price of oil climbed back up to $90 a barrel by that July, less than 6 months. It increased in the cost to over 250%, almost 300%. So the only thing that Obama has done that he said he would do is drive up the price of oil. He was wrong about the stimulus spending. He was wrong about TARP, which he voted for when he was candidate Obama. He's been wrong about the shovel-ready projects. Find anything that he has been right about other than following through with Bush's policy to get bin Laden. He followed Bush's nose he left sitting on the desk. Kill bin Laden when you get the chance.
Thanks for the call, JP. Appreciate it. And he was also right about extending the Bush tax cuts. But Salim, to JP's challenge, policies that Obama has been right about that have improved the economic life and opportunities of Americans.
Of course, you would have to factor in the morass that he found himself in when he came into office. I am not actually happy with many of the policies that were enacted by the president. I think he was very timid in many of his stimulus policies. I think the health care.
You wanted to see bigger stimulus.
A much larger stimulus. I would have been with Paul Krugman's prediction. I think the health care bill was a disappointment in that respect. He caved in. I'm one of his supporters who was extremely disappointed in his lack of consistency and his lack of aggressiveness in confronting the Republican challenge, challenge.
What about taxes? Should taxes be increased?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the Bush tax policy should be completely forgotten about. I mean,
so taxes should be increased on every quintile.
Well, no, the higher quintiles that the president has focused on. I think that they deserve to be raised. I mean, if you look at the history of tax paying in this country and our relative position to other nations, it's clear that the wealthy in this country are not paying their fair share in a progressive taxation system. They're not paying their fair share.
Khalil, does President Obama have this problem of having to argue an abstraction? In other words, sort of what Saleem said, where I inherited a bad situation. But for the stimulus, but for the various government interventive measures that I took, things would have gotten a lot worse. Is that something that he can really sell? Things could be worse to the American public, or things would have been worse were it not for what I've done, even though they're not as good as we'd all like them to be?
Well, I compare it to the same thing on the Republican side when the Republicans said that we have not had another terrorist attack since 9/11, and that's a great achievement of President Bush. I mean, the truth is, ultimately, we won't know what the economic consequence in the short term had been of Obama's stimulus or Bush's stimulus. And we have to remember, these stimulus policies were really started by the Bush administration, not by the Obama administration. And the truth is, the guy inherited two wars and an economy that was in shambles. That's still in shambles, by the way. But I think things are getting better. There's a silver lining. And now maybe it's not mourning in America, but things are definitely getting better.
What's the silver lining?
The silver lining is that you have a stock market that was at 6,500, you know, in 2009, that now is at 12,500. I mean, people are actually feeling much better about their 401ks. They're feeling much better about the prospects for the future, even though they know or they feel like the country is going the wrong direction. But I think it's kind of like, you know, day and night, right? I mean, it's going to get much, much darker before it gets light out. And I think that it's morning in America.
To borrow a line,
absolutely.
Let's go back to the phone. Let's go back to the phone lines. David, now I'm serious this time. David joins us from San Francisco, California. Hey, David.
Hey, greetings. And I heard that resounding click. Yeah. Hey, you know, I couldn't disagree more with some of your guests. I see that America is really being played for fools. When I took financial management and economics, we were basing ourselves on some form of science. And this whole idea that nowadays we're firing the inspectors. America used to have bank inspectors. We fired them as part of the layoffs of cutting, streamlining government. So we fire the bank examiners. We fire the stock market, the security exchange analysts. We're firing them. We're firing FBI agents and translators. We're firing all of the people that are double-checking whether or not there are massive crimes happening. And as soon as we fire them, then these massive crimes expand. I was watching C-SPAN the other day, and they were talking on one of the contractor oversight panels about there are $800 billion worth of receipts that have been turned in, and at the Republicans are firing the examiners. They're defunding them in Congress. So that there are $800 billion worth of receipts from these crummy contractors like, you know, Halliburton and Blackwater and whatnot. $800 billion worth of receipts, and it's going to take them, if they started hiring people to double-check them, it would take them 7 years to deal with the backlog. But if they're committing fraud, their statute of limitations might be 3 years. It would take a massive amount of time just to find out if they're committing crimes, and in the meantime, they'll get up past their statute of limitations.
David, I get it. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Essentially, the lack of regulatory oversight is one of the problems. Pat Hughes.
We have far too many regulations in this country at the national level, at the state level, at the local level. I understand what the caller is saying. Apparently, there's some large conspiracy between the Republicans and Halliburton to do a bunch of bad, terrible things that are crimes. I think that's not true. We're overregulated. Our government is too large. It has too many employees. There are too many departments. And as a consequence, and we'll get to this, we have a $14.25 trillion debt ceiling that we're going to seek to raise here in the next month. So I totally disagree with that analysis.
And let's go back to the phone lines, actually. We've got Morris from Youngstown, Ohio, calling from WKBN. Morris.
Okay, well, that last comment just changed my point here, but I will start by saying, as someone who supports the president and wants to continue to support him, it appears he does. I would agree with one of your panelists. He's had a lack of follow-through. And I think history will show that they wasted that first 2 years fighting for health care. That is an unpopular policy. And now we're talking about jobs. But where do we go from here? He's going to have to hit a major home run or two, because even though he's ahead in most polls, I think a lot of people are disenchanted, and maybe a lot of Democrats and moderates will stay home. But furthermore, I don't see how anybody, that last comment by your Republican, how can anybody look at some of the other things that have happened the past 3 years and not think we need regulation? Was the problem on Wall Street too much regulation? Is that why those guys got to have the Wild West?
Thanks for the call, Morris. But Pat, I guess you're the Republican, so it must be directed at you, although I'm happy to chime in as well.
I mean, my comment was that we're overregulated as a society, and as a consequence, our economic growth is suppressed. As our government grows, our liberty and economic freedom contracts. That's just the reality. With respect to specific regulations, I'm not saying that we should deregulate our society entirely. I think that there needs to be oversight with the banking industry. There needs to be oversight with the Securities Exchange Commission and everything down the line. But my point is, you know, a lack of regulation isn't the reason why we're in this problem. The opposite is true. Regulations from the top to bottom at every level of government, the over-governing of our society, has led us to the circumstances that we're in right now. And I think the opposite position should take place. I don't think that we should have increased the size of the stimulus. I don't agree with Paul Krugman. What we should have done is eliminate capital gains taxes. And then that would have gotten people to reinvest in the economy instead of going through the stimulus and putting more cost out there. So I disagree that we need more regulation. We certainly need regulation in particular places. But overall, we're overregulated, and it's hurting us economically.
Well, there's an economist who writes for Forbes magazine named Mark Carden, and he's coined what's become the Carden rule, which is if you want to make a problem worse, introduce a legislative fix to it. And there's a book coming out that David Brooks wrote about this week in the New York Times on the housing bubble that really traces the regulatory regimes, the oversight, the regulation that was with the impetus to extend home ownership and what that did in terms of leading to the housing bubble. I want to talk about that, and I want to talk about taxing and spending and the debt ceiling and the political implications when we get back with your calls on Beyond the Beltway. Dan Prost back with you and my distinguished panel on Beyond the Beltway, sitting in for Bruce Dumont tonight. We're talking about the economy as it relates to presidential politics. And specifically with the debt ceiling 30 days away, Pat Hughes, you were talking about it before in terms of the $14.25 trillion ceiling. Are we going to raise it or not? Republicans trying to extract meaningful spending cuts. The president and specifically his Treasury Secretary, Geithner, being pretty aggressive with Republicans in terms of saying that if Republicans don't kind of agree to compromise and raise the debt ceiling, you're talking about America defaulting on its obligations for the first time, and the serious consequences that would relate to that. I set that up with this context. You know, we talk about trillions of dollars. I think people have a hard time conceiving of what those numbers really mean, and so they lose meaning because we talk about billions and trillions. But let me try this. Last year, the federal government took in $18,000 per American household in revenue. And it spent $31,000 per American household. So it spent 31, it took in 18, it repeated that 115 million times, and that math doesn't work, not even in Washington, D.C. So against that backdrop, is it unrealistic or inappropriate that the Republican Congress that rode to control of the House based on reining in runaway federal spending would use this opportunity to demand meaningful reductions in federal expenditures from this administration? Salim Muakil.
Certainly. I mean, they have to play to their base. Indeed. In fact, that is the reason for this impasse, is that the mature Republicans, even they now have been cowered by the Tea Party activism to demand deeper cuts and not be not to acquiesce when the president offers what they consider half-hearted measures. So yes, absolutely, they have a political benefit that is shining in their face if they are resistant to this. So I'm not surprised at all. I just think that it's irresponsible, and I think that they need to be a lot less beholden to those Tea Party pastors.
And you think it's irresponsible because the solution to right that equation that I just described is on the revenue side, to increase taxes to equalize revenues and expenditures,
Absolutely.
But not necessarily to cut spending.
Oh, not necessarily. I mean, you know, we need to cut some spending. Although, you know, there are costs to cutting spending as well. Some of the educational cuts and whatnot are manifesting themselves in increasing kinds of crime that we see in various cities. In Chicago recently, we've been afflicted with what people call flash mobs and whatnot. And I think we're getting a glimpse of the costs that are connected to this mania for cutting spending.
And some of the costs, Pat Hughes, are also political costs. And there's concern among Republicans, some of the establishment Republicans Salim was referring to, about taking on entitlement reform as aggressively as Paul Ryan has proposed, in terms of not just cutting spending, but actually completely rethinking these big programs where that eat up a lot of our tax revenue. Loss of a special election in New York State, a congressional election, Chris Lee's old seat, has maybe furthered the nervous tension within Republican caucus. But on the other side, you've got the Tea Party base that Salim referred to that is clamoring for real, substantial, lasting spending cuts. That's why we sent you to Congress. You better do it or we're going to hold you responsible come 2012. How do Republicans navigate? How does John Boehner navigate these waters? How do Republican presidential candidates navigate these waters?
It's a very difficult problem. I believe in the notion that the Tea Party is one of the best things that's happened to this country in recent times because they are holding elected officials accountable for what they promise. And oftentimes what happens is, you know, I was a candidate, Dan was a candidate, you know, you make promises and you want to keep those promises. These guys and gals go to office and they don't keep them. And the Tea Party is holding these people accountable for what they promised they would do. And it's particularly important now because what needs to be done is that things do need to be restructured. We have, you know, non-discretionary spending is going to make us bankrupt over time, specifically Social Security and Medicare. And I think that we have to start with this debt ceiling argument. The notion that we're spending $31,000 per person and only taking in $18,000, and the idea of cutting spending is somehow controversial, is amazing to me. We should be cutting spending immediately and across the board. As to the raising revenue side of it, we can't increase taxes. We're at very, very painfully slow growth in this country, and if you raise taxes right now, it would crush the opportunity for us to permanently remove ourselves from the opportunity of being faced with a double-dip recession, and I don't know what would happen if that happened, but nothing good. And Boehner and the Republican presidential candidates have better find a way to marry those two ideas. I think the Tea Party in this instance is correct, and all the Tea Party is, Dan, as you know, are fiscally conservative Republicans trying to hold their elected officials accountable for a spending spree and mismanagement of the fiscal affairs of government that is now out of control.
Now, Khalil, the debt ceiling can be extended by dollars or it can also be extended by days.
Both.
And Republicans have that option that they, you know, kind of in their back pocket.
Right.
But let's say this game of brinkmanship goes right up and through the deadline and there is either a modest extension in days or nothing. Or how do you see the political implications playing out for both sides?
Well, we've already been warned by the S&P credit rating agencies that effectively we're running up against the wall, right? I mean, we have to be very careful not to lose our AAA rating. I mean, this is one of the greatest countries on earth, and we have the ability to do some marvelous things. One of the worst things that we can do is threaten our ability to borrow money that keeps our government going, that keeps our nation going. I mean, truth is, when I hear my friends on the right saying, well, we need to cut spending, from where? Like, who are you going to cut it from? Are you going to cut it from Social Security? Are you going to cut the troops off that are fighting very gallantly in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya. Are you going to cut it?
Yes.
Where would you like to cut it from? When I hear, I mean, you're not immune either, my brother Salim. When I hear people on the left saying, like, we need to increase spending, like from where are you going to borrow the money, especially considering the fact that we're running up against this debt ceiling? I don't think that the solution to bad governance or bad economies is more or less. I think it has to be more and less. More in the ways that actually make sense and less in the way that doesn't. And I'm just frankly getting fed up with the political climate in this country, where the left says more spending, and the right says less.
We're going to have to leave it there and pick it up on the other side. Dan Proft, my distinguished panel, Beyond the Beltway, back with your calls in the next hour. 1-800-723-8289, taking your calls and talking more politics. This is Dan Proft in for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the offices of the new Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street in beautiful downtown Chicago. Our toll-free phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. My panel this evening includes Republican Pat Hughes, former candidate for U.S. Senate here in Illinois. He's also a real estate developer and an attorney. Our Democrat tonight is Salim Muakil, who's the senior editor of In These Times magazine and a radio talk show host his own self on the Salim Muakil Show on WVON Radio in Chicago. And Khalid Marar, assistant professor of political science at DePaul University in Chicago and author of the book The Arab Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. We're talking presidential politics, taxing and spending, and your comments panel has lit up the board. So why don't we go to Dorothy in Portland, Oregon, listening to us on KCMD. Hi, Dorothy.
Hello. Thank you. I have the solution. All that Obama has to do is to don't raise the taxes. Begin with, don't raise the taxes.
Okay, we're with you so far.
Okay. And if he cuts spending, that's only one way to do that. And that is to not to take the illegal immigrants off the dole, because the money that is supposed to be going to the senior citizens, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, that money has been taken from them, and that money is going to the illegal immigrants, which have no right to it. They have no right to our money.
Dorothy, thank you. I appreciate your point. Pat Hughes, is that an area of spending cuts that Republicans should focus in on?
Well, I think what the sentiment that Dorothy's saying is correct with respect to how the money that's supposed to go to Medicare and Social Security is being spent in ways that it was not intended to. It was supposed to be saved for those purposes and hasn't been. I agree that it's extremely important that we look across the board and cut spending to get in line with the amount of revenues we're bringing in. And we cannot raise taxes for the reason that I said before. It could potentially lead to the double dip recession, which would just be devastating. So spending cuts is first and foremost. And if I was the Republicans, I would hold out on getting serious spending cuts as they've tried to do so far.
Salim Muakil.
Yeah, I think one of the dangers that we often run into when we have these contractions of the economy is the kind of intramural fighting that we engage in as a nation, blaming the illegal immigrants for diverting funds from senior citizens is not an accurate equation there. And I think it would benefit us all to be a little more reluctant to make these kind of blanket denunciations of groups as the cause of our problems.
Well, but let's say this. Let's say that even if you removed persons who are here illegally from our Medicaid and Medicare rolls, let's concede the point that would not solve the levels of budget deficits and federal debt that we're talking about. But is that something that should be part of the discussion? Is that something we should do?
Well, I think we should engage in that discussion in a national forum in a way that grants the kind of legitimacy to the arguments of those who are making the point that we need to we need to account for the well-being of people who live here. Otherwise, we wind up paying for it anyway, and exorbitant hospital bills.
Khalil.
Well, we have to be careful about ganging up on one group of people, illegal immigrants. I mean, the truth is, when my family came to this country, I am an immigrant. We were here legally at first, then we became illegal. And there was really nothing to be had as far as state services. And we really, frankly, didn't know that there was such a thing as state services. So, I mean, the avenues are closed for illegal immigrants to take from this country any more than they contribute. I mean, the truth is, I'm not in favor of illegal immigration. I think we should have an appropriate and decent and humanitarian way
Absolutely.
To allow immigration to this country. I think that you should be penalized if you're here illegally. And I think it's already penalty enough to be just illegal and undocumented. So we have to be careful on ganging up on a group of people that really does not deserve it. I think we're a very generous people. The American people are very generous, and I think we have to live up to that generosity. We're a good people fundamentally, and we have to live up to that good. And to gang up on a group of people is really immoral
and
wrong.
And we have to be very attentive to the social tensions that often accompany these kinds of economic contractions. That's what brings down many societies are the social tensions
right.
that are attendant to that, and I think we need to be much more careful about inflaming these tensions.
I might also suggest that what brings down a lot of societies too is spending more than you have in perpetuity. But let's go to Chris in Palatine on WLS. Hey, Chris.
Gentlemen, good evening. The Bible says, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set ye free." Mm. Here's the truth. Not one penny of the deficit today has been caused by Social Security or Medicare, and for the next 10 years, not one penny of the projected deficits will be caused by Social Security and Medicare. Why? Because they both have significant surpluses in their trust funds that have been collected by taxes specifically to pay for them. Any comment that the social spending, that the entitlements is causing the deficit and will cause the deficit over at least the next, 13, 14 years is a total lie.
Well, Chris, the truth shall set you free. Medicare, you understand, is funded by payroll taxes, right?
Yes, exactly. And it has a surplus.
Chris, actually, just let me jump in here. The payroll taxes do not cover Medicare obligations, Medicare and Medicaid obligations.
I'm talking about current expenditures.
The revenue generated by the funding source for Medicare does not cover the costs,
there is a surplus in the fund that has been accumulating over the last 20 plus years. That covers any kind of deficit spending. Likewise, there is a surplus in the Social Security fund that covers any cash flow deficit that's in expenditures for Social Security.
I think the last person who believed in the Social Security lockbox was Al Gore, but I'll let Pat Hughes jump in on this.
I mean, it's an irresponsible comment. The Bible quote is not only irresponsible, it's kind of offensive, actually. I think those two funds are going to become insolvent in the not-too-distant future, and they're going to become insolvent because we need to reprioritize how we spend money in this country at the governmental level. And in order for us to decide how our country is going to progress in that way and not become, like Dan said, a country that fails economically, we need to look at these things right now, prospectively. And to not do it would be a huge mistake. And so I think we have to take on Social Security. I think we have to take on Medicare. I think we have to take on structural, discretionary, and non-discretionary spending. And we have to find a way to get that 18,000 number and that 31,000 number to get closer together.
Well, I'll tell you what. One other thing, just in terms of injecting some truth. When Social Security, I think most people understand Social Security is pay as you go. There is no trust fund. Secondly, when Social Security was created, there was 42 workers for every retiree. Today, it's just a little over 3. In the next 25 years, it's going to be barely over 2. And so, the point about illegal immigration, we're going to have to create a lot more jobs and have a lot bigger workforce to accommodate the benefits that people expect from Social Security upon their retirement. We'll pick up this discussion on the other side of the break, Beyond the Beltway. Take your calls, 1-800-723-8289. Dan Prof back on Beyond the Beltway, sitting in for Bruce Dumont with my esteemed panel of experts and pundits and lawyers and professors and columnists and radio talk show hosts. And that's just the three of these gentlemen. let's continue to take our friends in the listening audience. We've got Tim in Otis, Indiana, listening to us on WoWo.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. Really appreciate it. And happy 4th of July to our country and all of our servicemen and women.
Yes.
The discussion, what a panel. Thank you very much for your panel. Let's look at where we can cut realistically and what we're going to have to look at. Unfortunately, we're in wartime at this time. Right. However, that doesn't mean we can't look at the Pentagon and cut what some might want to dub as possible earmarks on their 6 to 8 week testing projects. And these are steadily handed year after year in the tune of no less than $500 billion a year. And that's all they are test projects. We don't use them. Technically, we don't need them. Technically, the research is just paperwork. And this is an area that really needs to be focused on in order to stimulate, one, to keep this country moving without raising the debt ceiling, without affecting very little layoffs, and to keep the economy flowing. This is one area that has a huge over budget that can be cut. And
well,
go ahead, I'm sorry, Dan.
Tim, let me jump in. So defense spending accounts for rough numbers, about 20% of all federal outlays, right?
Yes.
How do you square what you're saying in terms of looking at DOD with our seeming increasing responsibilities, even taking the troop drawdown in Afghanistan into consideration, our ever-extending responsibilities across the world for deployments and support for international efforts like in Libya? I mean, how do you square the circle there?
When you look at the pie chart, Dan, this has been tabulated already. If we had a 20% increase in troop deployment at our highest mark in the last 10 years, we would still have plenty of money left over by cutting this $500 billion a year just on these little earmarks. They're 4 to 6 to 8 week test projects. And this is already through the budget office, and this is circulating on the House floor. This is something that's coming to reality, and the facts are there, the charts are there, the figures are there. It's just a matter of getting rid of the scare tactics of, oh, my God, we're not going to get ammunition to the troops. It has nothing to do with the troops. It has nothing to do with our combat situations or deployment.
Okay. Tim, I appreciate the point. Let me let Khalil jump in on this. Thank you.
Yeah, I think, and first of all, you know, thank you, Tim, for sending out a shout out for our servicemen and women. I think we all need to take some time to reflect, especially on the 4th of July. But as to your point, I think you definitely have a legitimate point in the sense that, you know, you take something like the F-22, which is really this kind of like ghost fighter in every sense of the term, that really was designed for a Cold War advantage, to have an advantage against the Soviet Union. You have those kinds of expenditures. You have really this outmoded Pentagon way of conducting wars that really does not fit the 21st century warfare. And the truth is, you know, we have to reexamine exactly where these outlays are going to. They're definitely, you know, to starve the beast that we call defense spending in this country does not necessarily mean, you know, to deprive our servicemen and women of the ammunition they need. We not only have to reexamine it, but we have to really question, what is America's role in the world? Are we still the same superpower we were in 1989 or 1987, or are we different? And I would suggest that we are different. I think that the kind of wars that we're seeing in Afghanistan and Iraq are much different than the kind of wars we could have potentially seen, God forbid, in, say, Poland or Eastern Europe. And I think that we need to reevaluate not only our commitment to defense spending in this country, but we need to reevaluate exactly what our role is in the world as it stands.
And I'll tell you what, just to jump in on that point, I had the opportunity to go to the U.S. Naval War College a couple weeks ago in Newport, Rhode Island. And I know Department of Defense is an easy target for people that don't necessarily want to talk about entitlement spending, or just for people who think we're too militaristic or imperialistic or whatever the adjective, like Saleem, for example. but to the point, to your point, Khalil, about the thinking that is or is not going on about future wars, about capacity building, about the future of our armed services with the world in which we live, that not just in terms of military, but the geopolitical. The good news is, I think where you have distortions is mostly from the politicians, because the folks that I've been exposed to, and I've also gone to the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, the folks that I've been exposed to at the upper echelons of our military leadership are very thoughtful, very smart, very talented, and they're asking the same questions that we sit around and ask, having the same conversations that Tim prompted with his call. So I think the military and the leadership of our armed services, I think we're in good hands. Now, the political leadership, that's always a different story.
Well, even Gates made the point that we were over-militarized and we needed to be a lot more discerning in some of our expenditures in the various theaters that we're in. And you know, that as Khalil pointed out, you know, we're still basically operating in the Cold War mode. The war on terrorism came in quickly to fill in the vacuum that was left when the Berlin Wall fell, and we haven't had a time really, I think, to sit down and evaluate our place in the world. Where do we stand as a power, as a world power? How do we need to adjust it, considering the emergence of powers like China and India and Brazil? What does all of that mean? We haven't really considered that.
But do you subscribe to the statement that Obama made that America, you know, in terms on the subject of American exceptionalism, that America is exceptional? Americans believe America is exceptional, just as New Zealanders believe New Zealand is exceptional, and all these other countries. Do you subscribe to this theory that we're just another country and we have to kind of take our place in the world as just another country? Or should we be very vigilant and guarded and circumspect about our position as the preeminent power in the world?
I think that we need to be more circumspect. I mean, the notion that we are a hyperpower rather than a superpower, I mean, the lone superpower in the world, is a responsibility, I think, that is depleting our treasure. And that notion, that very notion, is a notion that we need to reexamine.
You know, I agree that it's an enormous responsibility. Unfortunately, I do believe in American exceptionalism, and I do believe that without our focus on being a responsible lone superpower, there are dangers that lurk if we're not there to deploy troops if necessary, if we're not there to build the defense of not just for this country but for other countries like we've done in our history, looking back in the first two world wars and beyond. So I think we have to be careful about reevaluating our position in the world. Our position is what it's always been. We're the greatest country on the face of the planet, the greatest people the world has ever seen, and we have a responsibility to the citizens of this country and to the citizens of foreign nations that depend on us, who don't have their own militaristic presence, who depend on us to keep peace throughout the world. And not to say that we should go into every theater to be the cops of different places, but it is our position and it's our responsibility, one that we should honor and take seriously.
Let's go to, we've got a call from Michelle Bachman territory. We've got Dale in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Hi, Dale. Oh, Dale's not up yet? Okay. All right. Well, Dale, hold on. We'll get to you in 1 second. Let's go to Brian in Roselle, listening to us, Roselle, Illinois, listening to us on WLS.
Hey, good evening, guys. Good evening. Which famous politician said deficits don't matter? Anybody remember that?
That deficits don't matter?
Deficits don't matter. Who said that?
GW.
That was Dick Cheney. Anybody remember that?
Yes, I do. I remember
that. He did say that. And how many times have we cut taxes during wartime? Only twice, and it was both during George W. Bush's term. And that's part of the reason we're in the mess we're in. Then the reason I called, getting back to the economy, was that 70% of our economy, so I've been told or read, is consumer spending. And, you know, Wall Street's been made whole. The stock market has doubled in the last year and a half, 2 years. The average guy like me on Main Street, we're still getting our brains beat in. And you guys gloss over the effect of globalization, which has put downward pressure on wages. So the average American guy is making less money now in real dollars. Then also, immigration is a problem. I'm in the construction industry. I see what illegal immigration does to my industry. It's lowering wages. That's why business groups like the Chamber of Commerce push for illegal immigration. Yes, we have to deal with the illegals in our economy, but going forward in the future, how many more are we going to let in? And how are we going to keep those that want to continue to enter our economy illegally out? And how are we going to deal with the unscrupulous businessmen that love to hire illegal immigration? You know, the average American guy like me is getting my brain kicked in. Right. My house has lost over 20% of its value. And none of these prescriptions you guys like to talk about are dealing with that.
Khalil Marar.
You know, I really feel for you. And I think that this is something that we have to confront. I mean, starting with the downward pressure on wages that globalization has presented. I mean, all these structural problems are something that we have to be dealing with on the macroeconomic level. But I think, again, to say that illegal immigration to this country is the sole problem would be misled. I think that there's a lot of well-meaning Americans that think that immigration is a bigger problem than it is. I think the real answer comes in how do we figure out...
Dan Prof back on Beyond the Beltway, sitting in for Bruce Dumont, and we're talking about the economy, the issue that's going to drive this election. We just had a caller from Roselle, Illinois, talking about being a guy on Main Street, a little guy that's getting hammered, even as, in his view, Wall Street has been made whole by the rebound in the stock market. I also noted this week Joe Biden, our vice president, was... before the AFL-CIO giving his de rigueur Workers of the World Unite speech, whooping up the troops for the presidential. And against the backdrop of 13 Southern California counties talking about secession, probably not a serious threat, but certainly rhetorically important to say these counties sending the signal, hey, we're tired of funding California's state excesses, unfunded pension liabilities, and so forth, something that's afflicting a lot of states. And you see the Wisconsin budget repair bill that drew national controversy and drew all the labor unions, the public sector labor unions, to Madison to protest Scott Walker. And now that it's been implemented, there was a report in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel just this week that some school districts are starting to reap the benefits of that now that they've got lower encumbrances with respect to pension and health care obligations. They're going from budget deficits to budget surpluses and looking at hiring teachers again. How much of this conversation that has happened state by state, public sector unions versus the productive, the private sector financiers, do you think is going to impact the 2012 election, with Obama clearly going to rely on big labor, as Democrats normally do, but some of the successes that states that have taken on labor straight away, even some Democrats right here in Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, the new mayor of Chicago, is taking a relatively hard line against some of the public sector unions and demanding concessions and changes in work rules. How do the Democrats walk the line to do what needs to be done to make the math work, but also to retain big labor's enthusiastic support? And do Republicans have a story to tell here to maybe attract some of those guys on Main Street, like our friend in Roselle, who feel like neither party has given them much of a solution to this point? Salim Uwakil.
Well, I think that the Republicans have to stretch to tell the story. They have to make a larger narrative stretch. Because I think there's a lot of buyer's remorse in many of these states, Wisconsin and perhaps now Minnesota, Ohio. A lot of voters are seeing that the Republicans are enacting policies that they didn't ask for, and the incremental improvements that you note in Wisconsin, I think, are only incremental. I think most of the public service workers and many of the union supporters, not just in public service unions, but in private unions as well, unions in private industry as well, are also beginning to mobilize. They're beginning to see a lot of these corporate attacks as a larger assault on some of the premises of unionized labor.
But what does it tell you, Salim, in California, when Governor Jerry Brown, not a conservative,
mm-hmm.
right, Governor Jerry Brown vetoes card check?
Yes. Does
that tell you that the landscape is changing sector unions have?
No doubt the landscape is changing. In Jersey, Governor Christie was supported by some Democrats as well. And in public and teachers unions, there's a widespread animosity growing among many people, many parents of students, that the teachers unions have become unmanageable as well. So there's an anti-union attitude that's out here that can be it can be exploited by Republican lawmakers, but they have to be very careful because they may overstep their bounds.
Well, it's interesting. There's a piece in the City Journal entitled Yesterday's Heroes by a former editorial page editor for the LA Times, and it talks about the public kind of recoiling even against police and fire. In San Francisco, for instance, the average pension for a firefighter is $108,000. That's the average pension. For a cop, it's $95,000. And residents of these communities and counties are saying, hey, we love firefighters and cops. We respect and appreciate the work they do. But nobody gets a blank check. And is there going to be this divide that happens? It started state by state and even locality by locality. But will it bubble up nationally and be central to our conversation about how do we get America's economy going again and the disparate pay and benefits between public sector and private sector in the 2012 cycle? Khalil.
You know, the folks on the right have really given public sector unions a bad rap. I mean, the truth is you folks focus on things like, you know, averages, like the $108,000 figure, when you don't take into account the fact that most public sector union employees do not earn that. They will never see that. It's basically a system that has benefited people at the top within those unions to the dismay and to essentially the lack of benefit, the absence of benefit for people that are at the bottom. I know people throughout the state here who are earning $29,000 a year, who are not getting anything for pay, who are paying into their pension, who basically have no promise of seeing that pension in the future. This is an issue of justice. It's not an issue of deficits. Like, how do we tell somebody who paid their whole life to the system to get their pension out that they're not going to have a pension anymore? I think that we need to be very careful as a society. And it's not just firefighters and police officers. We're talking here about teachers. We're talking about the fabric of our society. We're talking about the people who protect us, the people who educate us, the people that incarcerate the bad elements in our society. We have to take care with those people. And we have to make sure that not only are they properly compensated, but that they have something to retire on in the future.
But
it's only just and fair.
But, Pat, can we keep Khalil's promise for people that have paid into the system and give them their due, but cut a new deal on a go-forward basis that makes the math work?
Of course you can. And not only can you must, or it's not sustainable. And the folks who are currently entitled to the pensions won't get the pensions that they're entitled to because there isn't enough money to pay them. So it has to be restructured. We have to keep the promises that we've made to people now. But this is the same thing for Social Security. We've got to look going forward, what do we do with people who are younger, who haven't been paying into the system as long? That needs to be restructured. We have to raise retirement ages. We have to raise the contributions that they make in order for the math to make sense. And Dan, to your point about will this be a national issue, it's already a national issue because presidential elections, as you know, are based on the electoral math. And there are only so many states that are in play. And so long as these issues are bubbling up in the particular states, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Virginia, North Carolina, other swing states like that, those are serious national issues going on at the local level that could turn a state away from Barack Obama into the Republican nominee.
Or in the opposite direction. I mean, from away from the way they were leaning in the midterm elections back toward Barack Obama.
I don't think that's the case, Salim. And the reason I don't think so is there's very few people who are public sector employees. Very few compared to the people that are the public sector employees are getting their money on the backs of. And I think that this issue benefits folks that are looking for votes in the private sector because the private sector is so stretched. And I'm not talking about who the Democrats would refer to as fat cats or the $250,000 a year guys. I'm talking about the guy that called earlier, the construction worker. He's suffering. He's going through pain. And because of that, he's going to hold someone accountable. And I think if you held someone accountable today, that would be Barack Obama.
We always talk in the private sector about retaining the best talent. Where is the talent going to go if we don't properly compensate those people and if we don't live up to our promises to them, whether they're firefighters or teachers or police officers?
Well, I think that's the whole discussion, right, is it's what's proper compensation. I mean, you hold a test for firefighters or police positions, and you've got some multiple of applications or applicants for the available spots. There's not a lack of demand for those positions. Now, that's not to, again, not to disrespect the profession or the people that perform those services, but it's to say what are numbers that we can make work. The conversation to me seems to be seems to have a simple starting point. Nobody gets a blank check,
and
so we start with what can we afford, what is reasonable, yeah. what is the price point by which we attract talent, but that we can also finance.
I think it's definitely a worthwhile conversation, but we should never under any circumstance do it on the back of hardworking individuals who are teaching, who are putting out our fires and who are protecting us. I think that's immoral. It's wrong. And not only that, it doesn't work ultimately. You're not going to recruit the best talent with this price point that basically is really bereft of any way to make a decent salary or a decent living. People are just going to get driven away from teaching and firefighting and police officers in droves.
Let's go to back to the phone lines. We've got Michael in Spokane, Washington, listening to us on KXLY. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call, and happy 4th of July to everyone.
Happy 4th.
God bless America. God bless our troops. To me, America is still the greatest country and the exceptional country in the world.
Amen.
But Social Security should not be privatized. For many people, Social Security is their only source of income. Raised to age 72, either some of these people are in poor health and won't reach age 72. Where we should cut Planned Parenthood, who receives millions of dollars, tax-funded money from Americans, to perform abortions, which most Americans don't want tax money going to Planned Parenthood for abortion.
Michael, thanks for the call. Pat, you said the Social Security age should be raised. Michael says, no, it shouldn't.
Well, first of all, I'm also for defunding Planned Parenthood, just as an aside. what I think should happen is, President Bush was on to something after the 2004 election, and then it lost the muscle that it needed to go forward. You know, this idea of allowing people to sort of start to make decisions at early ages in their life, whether to be in or out of the Social Security system. You know, really what's happening is you're taking, money from one group of people and transferring it to another. And there are a lot of folks that will benefit personally long term by opting out. They'll have more money at the end than they would otherwise, and it'll be money that they can pass on to their descendants once they pass on in this life. So I think there is a way to do that. Certainly we don't want to take Social Security benefits away from the people who have them, because like Khalil said earlier, they've been paying into it for so long and they've depended on it. But with the next generations coming up, they haven't made that commitment. They're not dependent in that way, and we should be looking forward in that respect with how we manage that cost going forward.
Back with more of your calls on Beyond the Beltway. Dan Proft back on Beyond the Beltway, sitting in for Bruce Dumont on this Independence Day weekend. And I thought we'd switch gears a little bit. We spent the show talking about presidential politics, both on the domestic side as well as foreign policy. But since it is the celebration of our nation's birth, I thought it might be interesting to reference a piece by a Stanford education professor named William Damon called this was posted on the Hoover Institution site, which is an adjunct of Stanford University, a piece called American Amnesia. He reports on a Department of Education study that found only 9% of U.S. high school students are able to cite reasons why it is important for citizens to participate in a democracy, and only 6% of high school students are able to identify reasons why having a constitution benefits the country. Some of the answers to the questions, the survey that was done, include, and I'm quoting here, this is a high school student. We just had American citizenship the other day in history. I forget what it was. Being American is not really special. I don't find being an American citizen very important. Professor Damon goes on to reference actually law professors who say in more eloquent terms the same thing these high school students are saying, such as one law professor who recently wrote, "Longstanding notions of democratic citizenship are becoming obsolete. American identity is unsustainable in the face of globalization." And, of course, Professor Damon laments this and talks about why there are reasons to have justifiable pride in America and American traditions. A few huge success stories of America just in the 20th century that he points to, of course, the civil rights movement, victories over totalitarianism in World Wars I and II. Building of a middle class that offered economic freedom to millions of ordinary citizens and immigrants coming to America in search of a better life. And I wonder, I'll start with our professor at DePaul University, Khalil Marar, what is the quality of students you get in your classes, your political science classes, and their sense of American pride and the importance of being a responsible, civic-minded citizen?
I have very good students, I must admit, but at the same time, they need direction. And I think that what those comments that you're reading, as disturbing as they are, demonstrate is the fact that we have basically a lack of direction. I think we need to renew our commitment to civic culture. There's something that happened in this country in the 1960s and 70s and 80s where basically we began taking our American identity less seriously. And I think that it's a great disservice, not just to immigrants like myself. It's a great disservice to people who are born here to not know what it means to be an American. To be an American means so much more than just being a member of a nation state. To be an American is really this ideal that we need to basically not only examine but reimagine and really go back to the roots of what it means to be an American, which is like literally a country that's born in life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. I think those are good ideals, and I think we need to renew our commitment to those ideals.
Pat Hughes.
I think what Khalil said was beautifully said. This is, as I said before, the greatest nation in the history of the world. I think we've been the greatest force for good that the world has ever seen, more freedom, more people free, more people prosperous, not just here, but what we've done across the world and the benefits that that's had on folks. And I think what people need to recognize is that we're inheritors of someone else's great sacrifice, whether it was at Antietam or charging the beaches at Normandy. And we have a responsibility to understand that heritage and what was left to us and what we need to leave to the next generation. And it's disturbing, A, to hear what these kids are saying, which is, again, an indictment on our school system, I no doubt public school system in that state, wherever that was taken. But also what this professor is saying is just ridiculous. And Khalil's point about the 60s and 70s and 80s is very interesting, because I think that's where you see the cross-reference of real far left wing liberal ideology taking over our schools, taking over our campuses, and this idea that America isn't exceptional. And that is taking hold, unfortunately, in students and our citizens. And we have to get that back, because if we don't, we're going to be weaker in the future as a consequence.
And we should start by not attacking our public unions.
Let me add a caveat here. For African Americans, this notion of America as the shining beacon, it doesn't sound as good as it does to others who may have benefited greatly from America's racist exploitation. And also, this country has invaded and subverted more countries than all nations put together in the last 50 years. And so to to look at this country as a kind of a uniformly great presence in the world, I think is a bit myopic. And that may be what some of these students are reacting to, this kind of myth America that has been propounded in much of the media. We're not, you know, we have, when you talk about American exceptionalism, we have exceptionalism in many, many other ways. We're the only industrialized nation that still accepts capital punishment. We don't have any sense of gun control. There are many, many things that we that make us exceptional, but not for positive reasons. And so, I think until we do a full accounting of America's impact on the world, we're going to have students who are a bit disaffected.
Let me read you something Salim. Let me read you something Diane Ravitch writes about this issue, an education reformer, fairly well known. She said, American students are being urged to identify with, on the one hand, customs from native lands they've departed, and on the other hand, with abstract ideals of an amorphous global culture. The absurdity, she calls it absurdity, teaching a student whose family fled this country from a tyrannical regime or from dire poverty to identify with that nation rather than the one that gave the family refuge.
Well, no, I'm saying, you know, there are good aspects and other than good aspects about this country. I think we need to be honest in assessing all of those aspects.
And, I think you're right. We are the country that's the home of slavery. We're also the country that's the home of the civil rights movement. And we have multiple traditions, right? And I think that the worst thing we can do is to teach our students the truly myopic idea that this country is only evil, that that's this bad force, right? We have to teach them, we have to also emphasize that to be an American means to try to do better, to achieve the greater good.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're going to wish everybody a happy Independence Day and safety to all our troops, men and women in the armed forces serving. This is Beyond the Beltway, a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio and Sirius XM Satellite Radio. I want to thank Tom Veracruz and Sylvia Chavez, as well as Mark Glick, who helped make this radio program possible. Until Bruce Dumont returns next week at this time, this is Dan Prof. Good night from Chicago.